What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
What's stopping you?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
And welcome again to Call to Communion on this Thursday here on EWTN. Obviously, it is not any old Thursday. Today is Thanksgiving Day, the day that we set aside here in the United States to officially give thanks to our dear Lord for all the many, many blessings that we have. So we're not doing a live show today. We instead have a mailbag program cooked up for you. We have a whole bunch of emails that have come in over the past few weeks. We're going to get to as many of those as we possibly can. So today it is going to be our producer, Pedro Quiles, me, Tom Price, and Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm well. Happy Thanksgiving to you, my friend.
Well, I think you were telling me before the show a statistic that you encountered that the average American consumes 4,000 calories on this day.
It's true.
I don't, we're recording this ahead of time. I don't know that I will be consuming the full 4,000, but I think I will definitely be indulging in a greater than average number of calories as this broadcast is aired and enjoying the company of family and friends. How about you?
Well, yeah, pretty much the same thing. We're actually having some folks over this year rather than with family. We're going to do it with folks who don't have other places to go. And very blessed to be doing that. Kind of look forward to it.
That's great. You know, for me, Thanksgiving has personally always been one of my favorite holidays. And I think it was because as a kid, I lost out on the present side of things, but there seemed to be fewer obligations of a child other than just to spend time with family and eat my fill.
Yeah.
And I always thought there was a kind of freedom involved. And, it's a secular holiday in the sense that, it's not something that's called for by the church's calendar. It wasn't instituted by the Catholic calendar. It was, finally made a thing by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War.
That's right.
but hearkening back to religious roots and Thanksgiving masses and Puritan celebrations as well, that's part of the nation's founding in history. But I'm tremendously grateful for it.
As am I, and I know that all of our listeners share that. We're going to lead off with an email here from John, who says, "How do I engage in dialogue with people who believe in faith alone?"
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So let me answer this two ways. One, how do you engage in dialogue with them? And secondly, what's incorrect about the doctrine of faith alone? And those are not necessarily the same answer, right?
Okay.
Because the way you engage with dialogue with anybody is you establish a positive, friendly rapport with them in which discussion about religious issues could be profitable. What I mean by that is it's very easy to get locked in a polemical head-to-head with somebody where you're swapping exegetical comments and each side is attempting to best the other in rhetorical debate. Often those kind of engagements are not very productive in terms of moving people to religious faith. They may have a lot of fireworks, but I don't know that they convert a lot of hearts. They can. I think the most important thing is that you have a person of goodwill and that they feel like you're not trying to proselytize them and they're not trying to proselytize you. And you're just having a genuine, open, friendly dialogue because you're both interested in the truth as such, right? Now, when it comes to the question, how should you discuss it or think about it exegetically or theologically or historically? So this is the thing that made me Catholic, right? Because I grew up in a church that taught we're justified by faith alone. And I came to the conviction that that was false. Now, when Protestants say you're saved by faith alone, that's actually a thick statement, all right? There's more to it than that. And typically the way it's worked out is this. There's a whole theory of the atonement behind that doctrine, whereby Christ dies on the cross so that he can be punished in our place. God pours out his wrath on Jesus and then imputes the righteousness of Christ to believers so that you're counted as righteous for Jesus' sake even though you're not righteous. And that the application of redemption takes place through faith. So when you believe that Christ died for your sins in that way, Christ's merits become yours, your guilt becomes his, and you get into heaven scot-free, right? And there are some proof texts that Protestants will point to justify that point of view. I mean, they note in particular St. Paul's teaching that we're justified by faith and not by works of the law. And the Protestant position is, well, hey, you know, if you're not justified by works of the law, you're not justified by works of the law. So it ain't anything you do. And they would look at passages like 2 Corinthians 5, where Paul says that, you know, in Christ we become the righteousness of God. And they go, well, hey, there it is. Slam dunk case, man. Justification by faith alone. What happened to me is that I found out that that was absolutely not the case, that they were misreading those passages. And the pathway in for me was, first of all, to recognize how the early church, Greek and Latin, knew nothing of Luther's doctrine of justification by faith alone. If it had been the plain sense of the Bible, which is the Protestant perspective, you would have expected the Greek church or the Syriac church or the Syro-Malabar church or the Assyrian church or the Latin church, or you have it. Some ancient Christian community would have read St. Paul's teaching and walked away with Luther's understanding. None did. None did. In fact, nobody from history held Luther's position until Luther, 1,500 years. That is a clue right there that whatever the Bible means by justification by faith, it is certainly not obviously Luther's point of view. Else, somebody else in history would have come upon that perspective, and no one did. And that's not my conclusion. That's the conclusion of Protestant biblical scholars and Protestant historians like Alistair McGrath in his two-volume History of the Doctrine of Justification. So what does Paul mean when he says that we're justified by faith and not by works of the law? He means exactly what he said. You're not justified by works of the law. Of what law is he referring? The Mosaic law. It is not by possession or adherence to the Mosaic code that a person becomes justified by God. Rather, Paul says, it's not a being a Jew outwardly by what's done in the body through the hands of men, namely circumcision. Rather, it is being a Jew inwardly when one is circumcised in the heart by the Holy Spirit that one actually is justified, because it is thereby that one keeps the righteous requirements of the law. Go read this, Romans 2, verses 25 to 29. And that transformation of our moral character takes place through faith. As we believe, the Holy Spirit is poured into our hearts. His love is poured into our hearts, Romans 5:5. And it's love, fundamentally, not the legal nitpicking of Mosaic code, that fulfills the law, Romans 13:8. So the Catholic position is Paul's position, that faith is necessary because it's through faith that we enter into the relationship with Christ that morally transforms us in such a way that God can look at us and say, in virtue and justice and truth, well done, good and faithful servant. Another time we'll get into why the Protestant doctrine of the atonement is wrong and how Catholics understand the death of Christ and its relationship to our justification.
John, thanks for your question. It's kind of one of the bedrock questions that come up time and time again. Always glad to tackle that here on EWTN's Call to Communion. In a moment, we'll get to some emails from Mildred, Diana, Wayne, Teresa, and lots more on this special mailbag edition of Call to Communion for Thanksgiving. A very happy and blessed Thanksgiving to all of you from EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Not taking your calls today. We're doing a special mailbag program, which we do every so often. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. So, David, thinking back on all the Thanksgivings that you have been able to share with family and friends, is there one in particular that stands out in your mind, maybe from childhood or maybe when you were a young guy or newly married or anything like that?
You know, one thing that stands out in my mind, and I've often on this show, when I went to illustrate the nature of the wound of original sin known as concupiscence, which is the immoderate attachment to bodily pleasure, I have settled on one standard illustration of that in my own life, which is that I have a congenital immoderate attachment for pecan pie, right? And I don't eat pecan pie anymore because I basically can't. My diet and health are such that I just can't imbibe that much sugar anymore. And I've said that, but it doesn't stop very kind listeners from occasionally sending me pecan pies, which will then get distributed in the radio office because I can't actually eat
to which
anymore.
We're very grateful.
Right, we're all grateful, right? But anyway, so I think it's sort of this reverie of pecan pie, you know, that I had a great aunt who lived in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who had a pecan tree in her front yard. and my great aunt would make pecan pies, and my grandmother would make pecan pies, and then the other grandmother would make pecan pies. My mother would make pecan pies along with a French silk chocolate pie. And you know, for a little boy in Alabama in the 1970s and early 80s, you know, this surfeit of pecan pies, and ice cream, of course, would be that. I think that was deeply, deeply, deeply memorable.
It's pretty awesome. I was mentioning earlier about having a Thanksgiving celebration that we're having at our house for folks that, you know, just don't have any other place to go, and we're glad to do that. We did that. I remember one time, probably 20 years ago, we hadn't been here in Alabama that long, and we thought, well, we're kind of orphans here in Alabama. Maybe we could open our home to... Anyway, long story short, we had a house full of probably 30 people.
That is a lot of people.
It was a lot of people, and you know our home, it's not that big. And we thought, well, you know what? We're going to make everybody sing for their supper. And it didn't involve singing. It involved... We just went around the group. We were all in a big circle, and we said... Tell the group here, if you don't mind, what you are most thankful for on this Thanksgiving Day. And we got just such a wonderful variety of answers. And that has stuck with me all these years.
You know, when I was a really small child, my grandfather, who lived in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, belonged to a dinner club, you know. And he would often host us for holidays and family events at his dinner club in Tuscaloosa. But when my brother and I were young, you know, say under the age of 8, he was too embarrassed to host us out in the public dining area. So he would always get a private room at the club, and we would run around like wild hooligans. You know, that was another memory that came to mind.
That's a great one. Here's an email now from Teresa on this mailbag edition of Call to Communion. What is a good book for fallen away Catholics? There's not many young people that come to my parish.
Okay, so if you mean a book that you would give to young people who are not practicing Catholics that could persuade them to become Catholic or come back into the Catholic Church, you know, I was interviewing one time for a podcast I did for the Diocese of Birmingham, Deacon Keith Strom, formerly the head of evangelization for the Archdiocese of Chicago. That interview is still out there, by the way. You could find it on the web if you look for David Anderson Keith Strom. Uh-huh. And today, Deacon Strom runs a ministry. I think it's called M3 is the name of the ministry, not to be confused with the company in Minnesota.
Okay, right? That's 3M.
Exactly, that's a different one, you know. And it's focused on parish renewal. And he told me a story that on one occasion he and his priest were debating whether or not to be involved in a nationwide evangelistic campaign to reach out to former Catholics to have them come back to church. Uh-huh. And they decided against it. They decided at the end of the day that they wouldn't get involved. And the reason they did was, this is the reason they gave. They said, well, you know, the sociological and the statistical data suggests that one of the major reasons that people disengage from the Catholic Church is that they have not been easily engaged when they were there, right? Their efforts at participation and belonging and understanding were thwarted somehow, and they get invited to some other community and they get plugged in and they don't want to come back, right? And he said, well, what if we invite a bunch of people back and they come in and they find the exact same dynamic that drove them away in the first place? What will we have accomplished?
Ouch.
You know? And so they decided instead that they would place their energies and their efforts at renewing their own parish community, and in particular to try to establish and to develop a community of missionary disciples that would be more capable of receiving people who would come to the church and keeping them there.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that made an awful lot of sense, right? And my own research on the topic has confirmed that the strongest predictor of what people believe is who they in fact hang out with. And there's a sociologist, I think he was at Baylor, but I could be wrong about that, named Samuel Stroop, who published an article a number of years ago on religious orthodoxy, you know, the extent to which you hold to the orthodoxy of your church.
Uh-huh.
and a category that he called social embeddedness, which is the measure of how many of your friends go to church with you. If all of your friends go to church with you, you're 100% socially embedded. If none of your friends go to church with you, you're 0% socially embedded.
Okay.
And that, not surprisingly, that that there was a straight line correlation between social embeddedness and orthodoxy. The more you hang with people who believe what the church teaches, the more you believe what the church teaches.
Makes sense.
Right? Makes sense, right? And I just, in my own study, I just kept coming back to these kind of criteria over and over and over and over again. And the Catholic Church itself teaches, interestingly, in the First Vatican Council, if you think that there is an argument for Catholicism that I can give you that will compel the mind to accept the truth of the Catholic faith, if you think that, you're either a heretic or just in error, right? Because that's not the way faith works.
Right, right.
Faith's a gift, right? Newman, Cardinal Newman, now St. John Henry Cardinal Newman, now Dr. St. John Henry Cardinal Newman, wrote a book 150 years ago called An Essay in Aid of a Grammar of Assent. And he asks the question, how to understand the nature of assent, A-S-S-E-N-T, when people give their assent, their agreement to a proposition, how does that happen? And Newman concluded something that modern psychology and cognitive science has confirmed, that when people assent to a proposition, it is not because it has been proven deductively certain to them. It is because the proposition confirms or conforms to their basic intuitions about reality and what's good, true, and beautiful. And that means, and those intuitions are pre-rational. Like they occur before conscious reflection. And you know, you've often heard it said that people's conception of God has less to do with formal theology and more to do with the relationship they have with their dad. That's what I mean by a pre-rational conception. Right?
Okay.
And so what Newman, what Deacon Strom, what Samuel Stroop, another sociologist named Phil Davignon that published an article on this topic in Notre Dame's Church Life Journal, what they all kind of come back to is that if you really want to influence somebody to fully embrace the Catholic faith, it's necessary that you speak not only to their intellect, but that you have to capture those pre-rational intuitions. Like you have to appeal to their unconscious intuitive sense of what's good, true, and beautiful, and imprint upon them the awareness that the Catholic Church is good, true, and beautiful. Now, books can play a role in that. But if what they find in the book is contradicted in their experience, that's going to create cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. My wife, you know, when I told her I wanted to become Catholic, she had left the church years before. And she said, why? And I had read some stuff in books, you know. And she said, oh, David, you've just read this stuff in books. But that's not what the church is like on the ground, you know. And she herself was not willing to come back to the Catholic Church until she found people who contradicted the stereotype that she had in her mind about Catholics, right? And that doesn't mean that books are unimportant, but the book that is helpful to an individual is going to be more than a book that has a compelling argument. It's going to be a book that awakens that individual's moral imagination with a sense of what's good, true, and beautiful. For me, that was reading the Doctors of the Church. That was reading St. Augustine. That was reading St. Thomas. That was reading Cardinal Newman, right? That was reading the Lives of the Saints. And then it wasn't just about the arguments. It was about really awakening my moral imagination to a way of being in the world, the Catholic way of being in the world and of engaging reality that spoke to me at multiple levels. But the difficulty with evangelism is that there is no one-size-fits-all approach, right? Which is why the church emphasizes so much the importance of accompaniment, of listening, of relationship as the context in which real conversion happens. There is a Wake Forest sociologist whose name will come to me in just a second. I'll think of it in a minute, who wrote a book studying the dynamics of membership in RCIA communities for several years. Like who shows up in RCIA and actually becomes Catholic? And what he found, it's on the tip of my tongue, that guy's name. I'll get it in a minute.
You'll think of it.
Is that that the vast majority of people that come into RCIA to join the Catholic Church are there not because of dialectical argument, although some do, but because of relationships. primarily marriage or family or some extent, right? So, you know, if someone says, what book should I give my relative? The first question I'm going to ask is, A, does your relative want to be given a book, right? And B, what are their reasons for not being Catholic? That's why this show is listener-driven, right? Mm-hmm. I don't tell people why they should be Catholic. I ask them why they're not Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people will call and say, well, why should I be Catholic? Well, then I'll answer that question, right?
Sure.
But I want to hear what their issue is, and then I know what book to give them. For one person, it may be a question of scripture. For another, it might be history. For another, it might be psychology. You know, I never know until I talk to the person and get to know them. That's the important point that I'm making. If you want to bring people back to the Catholic Church, you know, start by inviting them for tea.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your question there, Teresa. And here's another book question. This is similar, but not exactly the same thing. This is from Diana. What is the best book for someone who is just learning about the Catholic faith for the first time?
Wow. Again, such a broad question and so many possible answers to give. So everyone should at least take a look at the compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
which is just the basic foundations of Catholic doctrine.
And right? It's in Q&A format.
And it's in Q&A format. If you're really ambitious, you could try reading the Catechism, but that's, you know, what, 800 pages or so.
Yeah.
If you want an introduction to the Bible from a Catholic point of view, I never tire of giving out John Bergsma's book, Bible Basics for Catholics. That's a great one, you know. You know, reading a conversion narrative mm-hmm. by a Catholic convert will sometimes take you in a narrative way, but systematically through the different elements of the Catholic faith that people have to walk, right, in order to become Catholic. You know, there's plenty to choose from. You could, you know, Scott Hahn's Rome Sweet Home, or Peter Kreft has recently written a new book about his conversion from Calvinism to Catholicism. That's one that I personally relate to very powerfully.
Sure.
You know, I wrote a book called The Catholic Church Saved My Marriage, but it's all about my journey into Catholicism and the things that helped me and my wife. And I mean, so you go, you know, you go pick one and take it and start reading it.
Diana, thanks so much for your email. And we'll go to break with this one. This is from Alice. What is the Catholic teaching on tattoos?
Catholic teaching on tattoos. Catholic Church has no teaching on tattoos. It has some principles that you could apply that I think are sensible. There's no ban on tattoos in the Catholic tradition. I know priests that have tattoos. I know seminarians that have tattoos. They're not disqualified for seminary for having a tattoo. I think the right rule here is the rule of prudence. So, you know, obviously, you know, I know Tom knows the guy too. I know a Catholic seminarian who has Our Lady of Guadalupe tattooed on his chest.
Yep.
You know, that would be better than, say, like, well, think of a lot of things that could be that are not Our Lady of Guadalupe.
Yeah.
I'll put it that way. You know, that's a matter of prudence.
Sure.
I would also say, you know, St. Paul had a rule that he was going to become all things to all people. Right, to the Jew, he would become a Jew. To the Gentile, he'd become a Gentile. Mm-hmm. To the circumcised, to the uncircumcised, like one uncircumcised. He'd eat meat with people who ate meat. He would refrain from people who refrained, et cetera, et cetera. I know a Catholic priest who I like a lot, think highly of him, and he doesn't fall on any of the kind of standard ideological camps that will so often characterize Catholics. Like, he's not a traditionalist, he's not a charismatic, he's not either of those things. But he shows up at all of their meetings, you know, like he goes to the traditionalist masses, he goes to the Novus Ordo masses, he goes to the charismatic masses, and his position is, you know, I'm going to be all things to all people in the hopes that I might win some, you know? And I think that you can apply that rule. Like, if I'm going to be living and ministering the mm-hmm. Catholic faith in a community where tattoos are almost sort of like the expected cultural norm, and I might be viewed as somehow, you know, prudish or something if I didn't have one, mm-hmm. maybe that's an argument to get one.
Maybe.
Now, if I'm in a context where it's the opposite point of view, maybe that's a reason not to, right? It's all contextual.
Alice, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we'll be getting some emails from Lori. Also get to one from Kathy, Bradley, Carl, Harold. Lots more straight ahead on this Thanksgiving Call to Communion on EWTN. We're answering your questions on the Mailbag program. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A blessed and happy Thanksgiving to you. We are certainly very blessed to have you in our audience today and every day here on Call to Communion. We've been doing this program for over 11 years now, and the blessings, speaking for myself, and I'm sure David feels the same way, the blessings just keep coming, don't they?
They do indeed.
They do indeed. Here's an email now from Harold. Is there documentation or primary sources of Eucharistic miracles for a person who would want to read medical reports before believing in them?
Yes, there
okay.
is. And right. and I'm trying to come up with the book title. I have, you know, the church requires independent review by scientists and medical experts of purported miracles. And I encountered a book one time by a non-Catholic physician or scientist whose job was to review some of these cases without being told that they were candidates for canonization.
Really?
Right. And I think it was a woman, if I remember. And I remember she wrote a book about the experience, and I've forgotten her name. And I cannot. I mean, it's been years ago since I saw the text. So there, there are such texts about the authenticity of miracles. Now, you know, there are hundreds of texts about purported Eucharistic miracles. In terms of the scientific analysis, I'm not as clear on that question of what documentation may exist. But I mean, these are topics that are near and dear to the Catholic heart. You know, honestly, you might poke around the EWTN. Bookstore website.
Sure.
I'm sure we have plenty of stuff on Eucharistic miracles and the canonization of saints in there. But yeah, I know there are such texts. I just can't come up with a title off the top of my head.
Harold, thanks so much for your email. Lori has a revelation question for you, David. She says, in Revelation 6:10, why are the martyrs so eager to have their blood avenged?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. The desire for justice is a perennial one. It's integral to biblical revelation, and you find it repeated from the Old Testament to the New.
Mm-hmm.
It's what undergirds the imprecatory Psalms. You know, break the teeth of the wicked, O God. I mean, this is one of the prayers of the psalmist. I would like you to imagine. You know, maybe you're a parent. If someone perpetrated a profound evil against your son or your daughter, you know, we make a big deal in culture out of parents like this who you know, the accused is apprehended by the authorities and tried and convicted, and the parent shows up in the courtroom and says, I want you to know I forgive you for this terrible thing you've done, and we love those people. We appreciate their generosity of spirit in saying that. But do they want the guy to go scot-free? Probably not.
Yeah.
And is it just because, well, we don't want this guy to offend again? Is that the only reason we don't want that person to go scot-free? No, I don't think so. I mean, even the parent that says, I forgive you, recognizes that there's a kind of retributive justice that needs to take place to restore the right order in society. It doesn't bring back the loved one who's lost, you know. It doesn't preclude the possibility of, you know, personal forgiveness, but it's an independent value that needs to be sought in this case. We wouldn't just say, judge says, you forgave the person. Okay, well, we're going to let them go now. They promised to reform. You know, we'll let them go. No, that's not, you know, why is there a public outcry when someone who is, his, you know, notoriously evil is arrested, and let's say this individual's rich, and so, well, they're given house arrest. Well, if they're given, I mean, we know where they are. They're not going to offend again if they're on house arrest. What's the outcry about? The outcry is because this doesn't seem just.
Yeah.
Doesn't say, why does the poor guy have to go in the slammer for, you know, 6 months waiting for his trial or whatever, and this guy gets house arrest? Doesn't seem right, right? There's a desire for equality there, and equity rather, and retributive justice. That's natural, that in fact undergirds the basis of God's justice. I mean, you know, God at the end of time, for God to vindicate the righteous and punish the wicked, is what God's justice consists in, right? And so if the martyrs and the saints say, we want God to establish his justice. They're not willing something other than what God wants. It is not wrong to want justice to be served.
There you go. And thank you so much for your email. That's from Lori. And we do appreciate that. Call to Communion here on EWTN as we continue with our mailbag program today. Here's one now from Kathy, David. Kathy says, what is the significance of the different vain sayings? Sayings like, oh my gosh, or oh my God. What is wrong about these?
Yeah, well, Scripture tells us, commands that we not take the name of the Lord in vain.
Right.
That we not use God's name in a cavalier or careless fashion. And the Catholic Church, you know, elaborates on that. We shouldn't issue curses and these sorts of things. Most languages have got curse words, and then they have, like, curse word light. You know, they have, like, you know, the version that you use to avoid using the version that you don't want to use.
Curse-ish.
Right? Curse-ish, you know. And I don't know that there is a you know, a sort of official teaching of the Catholic Church on, you know, should you use the the G version of the curse word,
mm-hmm.
or not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point of having a G version is it lacks the explicit note of
right.
of impropriety.
Right.
And it can, in fact, you know, there can almost be a kind of humor to it. You know, I know in French, there's a bad word I'm not going to use that's very common in French. There's the G-rated version of it, which translates into bed bugs.
Oh, my. Wow.
It always makes me laugh, you know, when I hear
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
You know, personally, I think I would have a hard time getting really bent out of shape if somebody said, you know, oh, golly jeepers,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think if I went to confession and I said to the priest, you know, forgive me, Father, I've sinned. What did you do wrong? Well, I said, oh, golly jeepers. I think I would not be taken seriously. One time I went to confession, one time to EWTN's very own Father Anthony,
uh-huh.
and I was enumerating my sins, and some of them were real sins, and then I got to this one sin that I felt really bad about, and he couldn't help himself. He chuckled. He was like, oh, Anders, that's silly. You know, don't even worry about that one.
Is that
one.
The worst you got?
Don't worry about that one. You know?
That's funny. Kathy, thanks so much for your email. I remember some 30 years ago when we lived in Minnesota, there was an older woman that we knew, a very faithful Catholic. What were you going to say?
Jacqueline Duffin, hematologist and medical historian. Published the book Medical Miracles in 2009.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
I found that text we were talking about earlier.
Oh, very good.
Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No. 30 years ago, a pious woman that we knew, and she would say, if she was upset about something or astonished about something, she would say, oh, my Godfrey. And I've always thought, I wonder, because she's of a certain age, I wonder if she's thinking of Arthur Godfrey, who was on radio and TV a million years ago. I don't know. Maybe so. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Here's one now from Bradley, who says, the NAB's translation of the Our Father, that's the New American Bible, their translation of the Our Father is different. Why don't we recite the version that is in the NAB?
The Lord's Prayer has different versions in different texts of the Gospels. There are subtle differences between them.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, you know, there are translation differences on top of that. But there is, as it were, a sort of liturgically normative pattern, right, that is standard in Catholic liturgy. And the same thing is true of translations of liturgies, that there's a normative translation that... that the church authorizes, you know, for different regions.
Mm-hmm.
And the important thing is that, well, A, that the church authorize it, and B, that we all be on the same page.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah. Translation is always a judgment call.
Sure.
And you know, every once in a while you have to update a translation because language becomes archaic and falls out of use and it stops being intelligible. And you need to, you know, come up with something that's in the vernacular of the people. But the most important thing is it needs to be theologically accurate and it needs to be uniform.
Okay. And Bradley, thank you so much for your email. Carl wants to know, how can I respond to a Protestant who says that veneration and treatment of the real presence in the Eucharist is modern and that some in the early church wouldn't have cared if some fell to the floor?
Right. Okay. So there's absolutely an evolution in the veneration or adoration, I should say, of the Blessed Sacrament. There's no doubt about that. The Feast of Corpus Christi, for example, is a medieval innovation.
Oh.
And there is actually a fair amount of historical evidence that some of the embellishments, let's say, of the Blessed Sacrament architecturally, artistically, and devotionally follows rather than precedes a similar development in the cult of relics. There's a dissertation from E.G. Brill, Leiden. I think it's by a guy named Schnook, S-N-O-E-K, if memory serves me correct, that makes that case at some length. He traces the historical connection in the West between Eucharistic adoration and the cult of relics. But all of that is beside the point, okay? From the earliest days, the practice of reserving the Blessed Sacrament is in evidence, and in particular, to demonstrate the communion between dioceses. So it was not uncommon for bishops in one diocese to reserve the Blessed Sacrament and then to take communion, literally the consecrated host, to another diocese, and they would have inner communion to prove that, like, okay, we over here in this diocese and you over here in that diocese, like, we're in communion, we're in the same church.
Really?
Right? So that's actually, it wasn't adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, it was the communion among churches that prompted the reservation. But as soon as you do that, you have to raise the question, how do you treat the thing? How do you treat the thing? And I would urge you, if you think to the contrary, show me the evidence that when the reservation of the Blessed Sacrament took place in this context, that anything other than reverence was the attitude towards the consecrated species. And the evidence is the other way around, that in fact, reverence toward the consecrated host has always been the practice. Now, that the forms of reverence definitely underwent an historical evolution. But reverence itself, no. Now, there's a good article on the Call to Communion website by a man named Tim Troutman about the doctrine of the real presence in the fathers that analyzes that phenomenon according to multiple modes. So one of them is treatment of the Blessed Sacrament. One of them is, the specific beliefs about the Blessed Sacrament that were affirmed, not only that it's the body and blood of Christ, but that there's a real ontological change that takes place, and several other categories of analysis as well. I think you'll find it compelling.
Very good. Thanks so much for that question. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. If you're just joining us on this Thanksgiving afternoon, we're doing a special mailbag edition of our program. Got quite a few more straight ahead. Don't forget, coming up later on, next actually, on most of these EWTN stations, it is Open Line Thursday with Father Gerald Murray. That'll be coming up next at 3 p.m. Eastern on most of these EWTN stations. Here's one now, David, from Mildred, who says, how could I help my Lutheran friend understand that the foundation of the Catholic Church is biblical?
Yeah, thanks. Understanding is one thing, accepting is another.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the text of Scriptures is Christ who says, Matthew 16. Lutherans know this text, of course. Thou art Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church. Right. Now, the Catholic position that the See of Peter has passed to the See of Rome, that conviction itself cannot be verified from the Bible, but it is the universal conviction of Christian antiquity. Like, you're not going to find anybody in the ancient church before the 4th century who thinks that Rome has the primacy for any reason other than the fact that it is Peter's See. Right?
Yeah.
That's the grounds that's given, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not in virtue of it being the empire. It's in virtue that it's Peter's See. And that Peter has the keys is evident from the text itself. I mean, Protestant biblical scholars, not just Catholics, say, look, exegetically, Peter's got the keys. I mean, he's the rock. I mean, you can't make the language say something other than what it means,
sure.
Right? Now, historically, why was that problematic for Luther? Well, because he didn't like what the Pope was doing. He didn't like what the Pope was saying. Right? It was a rhetorical necessity for him to reject the doctrine because it was profoundly inconvenient for his Reformation. because he had objectives that the Pope positively opposed. Now, Luther had said himself, he said, look, if the Pope would just agree with me on free justification, I'd kiss his feet. I'd carry him in my hands. He said this, is a quote from Luther, right? His objection to the papacy wasn't primarily exegetical. It was historical. It was practical, right? That the Pope, the papacy was an obstacle to what he wanted to accomplish.
Hmm.
And a pretty vehement one, too. I mean, the Pope excommunicated him in 1520, right? I mean, that's kind of a deal breaker, right? And the similar thing happened in Luther's confrontation with the whole concept of tradition, church authority, and canon law. So, you know, in the Leipzig debate, he was confronted by John Eck with the charge that he was teaching doctrines that had already been condemned by the Council of Conscience. And Luther's response was to say, well, then so much worse for the Council of Conscience, right? If it contradicts me, then I can't recognize it as an authority.
Yeah. Mildred, thanks so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. This is a question that actually came up earlier in the hour, but it's worded a little bit differently. This one is from Wayne. How do you lovingly talk to your family and get them to convert to the Catholic faith?
Two very different questions.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's how you lovingly talk to your family, in my judgment. First of all, you agree with them whenever you can. You agree with them all the time because they'll say something that's true, right? You listen to them and you express empathy. You show that you've heard and recognize the things that they feel, the things that they think. You refrain from criticizing them. You compliment them. Where you disagree, you hold your tongue most of the time, or you can talk about how you personally feel without making that statement into some sort of accusation or criticism. In other words, in whatever you do, you validate them and show that their humanity matters to you. You do that to just about anybody, and they'll be your best friend pretty quick.
Yeah.
If you treat someone that way, right? You could have all the apologetical truth in the world up your sleeve, but if you treat people like objects of manipulation, whose opinions aren't worth hearing and whose concerns are not worth validating, it doesn't matter how true your arguments are, they are not going to land, right? I mean, it's like a friend of mine I once was evangelizing, I thought, and argued about a particular point of doctrine, and I won the debate, and his response to me was, but Dave, I don't like Christians. You know, there's no comeback from a comment like that.
Nope,
you know?
Nope.
So how you talk to them is one thing. How you get them to become Catholic, well, the best way is talking to them that way, right? When you become the contradiction of whatever stereotype they hold about Catholic, well, Catholics are narrow-minded bigots, you know. So don't be a narrow-minded bigot.
Yeah.
Right? You see, like you undermine their objection to the Catholic faith by your life. You know, Peter, when he talks about apologetics in his epistle, he says you have to do it with gentleness and respect. It's one of the qualifications he offers about apologetics. He says, be ready to give an answer when anyone asks you for the reason that the hope that is within you. So there's another qualification. Apologetics is for when someone asks you.
Yeah.
It is not for you to go marching into the Thanksgiving dinner with your list of arguments that you're going to, you know, flop down on Uncle Fred. One time, I was at a Thanksgiving dinner, and I had a non-Catholic relative there, and I was still in a little bit of my more pushy days back then. And I turned to my non-Catholic relative, and I said, let me ask you a question. And one of my sons said, oh, Daddy, please, no arguing about religion today. I said, I'm not arguing about religion. I'm just asking a question. Yeah, but Daddy, that's how you argue about religion.
Oh, that is funny. That's
you know?
Funny.
So what Peter says is, you wait for them to ask you.
Sure.
You wait for them to ask you. Then you be ready to give an answer.
As I was reading the question, how do you lovingly talk to your family and get them to convert? The word that stuck out to me was lovingly.
Lovingly.
I mean, he kind of answered in a way. He kind of answered his own question.
Now, you know, one thing, when I became Catholic, it helped me a lot in this regard, because back when I was an evangelical Protestant, I thought that unless someone prayed the sinner's prayer vocally, verbally, you know, consciously, expressly,
verbatim.
Well, not verbatim, but like they had to have a conscious acceptance of evangelical Protestant doctrine, the way I would articulate it, and to give you know, mental and volitional assent to that, or else they were necessarily damned to hell.
Ooh.
Right? And so it was really incumbent on me to make sure that happened. And so I had a strong motive to kind of coerce people into that state of mind. But the Catholic Church doesn't teach that about people, right? It doesn't teach that outside the Catholic faith you are absolutely damned. It teaches that we need a transformation of our moral life, and that the Catholic faith is the divinely appointed means for bringing that about. But at the end of the day, it's the moral life. It's on the path of the moral life, to quote John Paul II in his encyclical on Veritatis Splendoris. It's on the path of the moral life that salvation is open to all. Catholicism is a path to the moral life, but it's the moral life that is the path of salvation. But it also tells me that I'm to take the log out of my own eye, not the splinter out of my neighbor's. And so if I'm sitting next to my non-Catholic relative, my disposition is very different than it used to be when I was a Protestant. It's not, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, they're going to go to hell unless I can get them to be baptized tomorrow. It needs to be, all right, what's wrong with me that they don't want to be Catholic? Where's the log in my eye? Where's the egg on my face that's keeping this non-Catholic relative from seeing the love and the beauty of Christ in my life? And in the meanwhile, what is there in their life that I might actually have to learn from? What is the beauty, truth, or goodness that they are exhibiting that I'm failing to see because I'm being a narrow-minded bigot in some way, right?
Yeah.
And then if I love them from that point of view, and I'm like Jesus, who got accused of eating with tax collectors and sinners and drunkards and prostitutes and so forth, and I'm not afraid to call them my friends, right? Then maybe, just maybe, through my loving attention to their deep humanity, God might just deign to use this worthless little instrument as something that could help someone come to a deeper knowledge of the Catholic faith.
Wayne, thanks so much for your call. We've got this one now from, excuse me, Melissa. Melissa says, what does the term gravely illicit acts mean? Are they the same as intrinsically evil acts?
An act can be intrinsically evil without being gravely evil, right?
Okay.
Gravely means it's a serious violation of human dignity or divine dignity. So okay. Let me show the distinction.
Yeah.
It is intrinsically wrong to steal ballpoint pens from the supply room at your office. Unless your employer says it's okay.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's intrinsically wrong to steal them and take them home for personal use.
Okay.
It is not gravely wrong.
Okay.
Right? To embezzle, you know, $500,000 from the company bank account, that's gravely wrong.
You bet.
They're both intrinsically wrong, but one is gravely wrong and one is trivially wrong.
Melissa, thanks so much for your email. Here's one now from Angela. Hope we can get this in 2 minutes. At the end of time, when there is a great persecution against the church, will it be a genocide? What will it look like?
Good question. Next. Don't know. Don't know, right? Don't know. All we know is it's bad. It's bad. But it's bad now in a lot of places in the world.
Yes, it is.
You know, I mean, so the 20th, 21st century, you've seen more slaughter of Christians, you know, for their faith than any other time in the church's history. So, you know, I live in Birmingham, Alabama, which is a pretty Christian place to live, and, you know, not a lot of persecution against Christians here. Seems like the apocalypse is a long way off. There are some places in the world where it might feel like it's upon me.
Yeah, for sure. And this one finally from Ryan. Can a priest ever break the seal of confession? Isn't covering up horrible crimes an act against justice?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. No. The priest cannot break the seal of the confessional.
No.
N-O. And the priest is not covering up horrible crimes. He's not conspiring to keep justice from being done at all, right? I mean, you know, when the Justice Department prosecutes somebody for tampering with the evidence or obstructing justice, I mean, this is a case when they're actively trying to frustrate the work of the authorities. That is not what the priest is doing. The priest is there to reconcile a soul to God. Do you want that soul reconciled to God?
Of course.
Right? I mean, like, if let's say someone's done a horrible crime against children. Well, don't you want their repentance?
Yeah.
That's the narrow scope of the priest's jurisdiction, to effect the repentance of that soul and their turn toward God, that they might not offend again. It's just not in his purview. It's not part of his job description in that context. In that context. Now, in another context, if he becomes aware of the very same sin outside the confessional, he's bound by church policy to go directly to the authorities.
Yes.
But in the context of the confessional, that his narrowly prescribed job right there is to reconcile that broken soul to God.
Ryan, thanks so much for your email. Dr. David Anders, may I be the last to wish you a happy Thanksgiving.
I hope you're not the last. I hope I see some more people between now and Thanksgiving.
Well, you know what I mean. And as we're airing this program Thursday. There you go. All right. Be sure to join us tomorrow for another edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. On behalf of our team here, which would be producer Pedro Quiles, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. We will see you then. Have a beautiful day. Don't eat too much turkey. See you tomorrow. God bless.